today on Code Pen Radio.
Hey everybody, time for another Code Pen Radio. It's going to be an all founders episode, like our humble beginnings. So I have Tim Savitt with us.
Hi. Hey there, Tim Savitt.
This is a heavy Tim episode. We'll get to that in a second. And Alex Vasquez. Hey, man.
Hi there. Hey.
Yo, the three of us are going to do this word has stuck in the Code Pen team Slack, a classic propeller head episode, which I hope isn't a derogatory term, but just means nerd. We're going to talk server stuff, like hardcore, Tim's specialty. A lot of AWS stuff and just all the infrastructure, the power. The thing that we're specifically going to talk about here is projects, as we promised. We've talked about the CodePen server infrastructure a number of times, and now that projects is out and we've been doing some podcasts on what it is and how it all works and our planning behind it, this is probably, I don't know, arguably the most important thing that made projects happen. I mean, I don't know. It's why rate things? But, you know, we talked about, you know, React and Redux and Immutable and all the like front end technologies that power it. That was huge and new and different for us. A few weeks ago, we talked about, you know, our planning for it and how we rolled out alpha and beta and stuff. That was big and new, weird territory for us. But what makes this all possible really is how does it work in the sky? So high level, Tim.
Yeah, this is that's me. I can talk about all this stuff. I don't know. I'm not going to say that. I guess what I'm saying is that this was difficult in the sense that there's no like in the past. If we're like we want to store something, we just grab a database, a managed AWS instance of RDS or whatever, and make it happen. But at the moment, a lot of the technologies that we're using, Docker and EFS and some of these things, they're so new. There's no roadmap for them just yet. This became one of the bigger, the biggest ops challenge of my lifetime. And so it was, pretty
the biggest
difficult.
One. So, and not only is there not that this stuff is new, but it's also not like we're not using it in maybe the most commonest ways in the world. You know, like how many Rails apps are there that like let you save and edit recipes? You know, like a million, you know, we're not building a CRUD app. We're building something really weird.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, there are people out there that are using Docker containers the way that we are, but each person's needs are like slightly different. And it's just a bunch of mix and match stuff. And that's kind of what we're doing here. We're going to talk about how we put together a bunch of like off the shelf free software products to make this sort of like unique projects infrastructure.
Yeah, definitely. One of the interesting things is that this was born a little bit from the idea that when we did put files inside of our relational database, we struggled because of it. So it is interesting that this is kind of in reaction to having created pens and the way we designed the data and knowing that there just kind of had to be a better way. I think 90 to 95% of the data in our database is pen, HTML, CSS, and JavaScript, and it makes it hard to use for simple things. And I think part of the design of the system is a reaction to that problem.
Yeah. I mean, we're essentially what we do with projects in general is take those huge files that you're talking about and store them on disk where they belong. Because ultimately what CodePen does is it saves your HTML, CSS, and JavaScript, and then it displays your HTML, CSS, and JavaScript. And the way we were doing that in the past, like, abused the database, and it also abused our servers in terms of serving stuff.
Yeah, I mean, think about that. In a MySQL database, a lot of us imagine almost like an Excel spreadsheet, you know, like each, you know, there's tables and rows and individual cells of data, and you're like, oh, it's a date, it's a number, it's a string, it's a true, false. There's all these things that you think of it. Or it could be 175K of arbitrary HTML.
And in our case, it's like up to 2 megabytes worth of arbitrary HTML, CSS, or JavaScript, you know? And that's not what DBs excel at. Like, they really don't do very well storing that and retrieving that, just because that's not what they're built for, really.
But there was reasons why we have stuck with that. Not even necessarily laziness issues, but we've looked at moving, and maybe we will someday. But like the advantages aren't blasting out the door for moving our entire database for pens. But not because we got to start from scratch, we could make better thing. So let's, you know, let's talk tech, but let's say, just in case anybody's like, what the heck is projects? It really is, I mean, and we've called it like this, even in marketing material a little bit, a file system in the cloud. It's an IDE that you use in the browser, and you can just make files on it. You can say, I need an about.html file. There you go. I want to upload an image, drag and drop. There you go. I need like data.json. It's 100K of that. Drop it in there. I need some CSS. You have arbitrary files, and they're not fake, like kind of like they are in the pen land. They really are files. Right. And we need a real file system to manage and process and deal with them. So that's what we're giving you. When you make a new project, you have a real file system in the cloud to play with. So that's what we're trying to build. And God, how the hell do you do that, Tim?
Just persistence, you know, every day, just giving 110%. No, I mean, we just use a lot of, we use, like I said, a lot of off the shelf tools. At a high level, it's like, it's a combination of about, six services, all kind of talking to one another over the network. And then surprisingly, when I wrote this up, I was blown away by the like number of boxes that this thing requires. It's 30 boxes to run our production stuff, not counting the Rails servers. That's just all the project related stuff. That sounds huge, but we're using T2 smalls for a lot of them. It's just there's a lot of like coordination and stuff like that that needs to happen, and each one of those needs, you know, at least each one of those nodes needs at least one backup node so that you're highly available. And in some cases it needs three of those. So it's just a big blob of servers all talking to each other over HTTP. It's pretty cool.
So yeah, I always am amazed by that when we talk about it. Cause I'm still not too far removed from, you know, like I work on CSS tricks. It's one server. It has all the stuff on it, you know. It's a little different than rolling out a feature at CodePen, which requires 30 different servers. Oh my God! So what are they? What kind of services? What kind of boxes are we talking? Do the checklist.
So yeah, I mean, we've got the six services are Rails. We've got this thing called Spawner that sort of manages where files are written. Another thing called Spawner Router that knows like where, like which Docker container is on which node. We use some stuff called a service called FluentD. And then we have two different apps for previewing stuff. That's like running Nginx and reading off the file system. And I can explain, you know, I'll be touching on each of these as we go down the list here. Later on in the show, we'll talk about like what happens to a file as it gets saved in projects. And I'll be sort of talking about each one of these as we go through.
So there's six types of services split, and there's multiple of each of those totaling 30.
Yep. Yep. Yep.
And the bulk of it is Docker.
I mean, So, I mean, really what's funny is you're the thing that's handling the majority of the work that's like running at high CPU levels is really only four servers. The rest of them are just like all these support services that need to sort of hang off and deal with the output of those like heavy lifting servers running all the gulp stuff. Yeah.
So that's funny. Like, doesn't a lot of this is just for the sake of radio and because I don't understand it, but can't you combine some of that stuff? Why is everything always like on its own box? Is that just like modern architecture, or it just has to be that way?
Yeah, I mean, in our case in particular, we're putting this thing together. We have no idea what the footprint of each one of these things is going to be. What's the disk usage going to be like? What's the network consumption going to be like? What are we going to do to CPU and memory? And we could conceivably, especially with Docker, run these on like one big old box. But the problem is we wouldn't have a whole lot of visibility or ability to scale individual pieces up and down. You know, I talk about the four servers that do the heavy lifting, these things we're calling spawners. They run at super high CPU, right? And if you have these other services that need to talk to that box or hear from that box, and they're choked because of the CPU usage of the spawner, you're going to, you know, the thing's going to fall down. And so what it does is it allows you to sort of tune this stuff individually by box. If we find we need more spawners, we just we just launch more of them, right? But we can keep the, for example, routers or the Fluent D boxes at their current level because they're not being overutilized. So it's our ability to basically pick the best infrastructure to match the characteristics of the application that's running on there.
That makes a ton of sense. Yeah, because you can all brought to you by the concept of load balancing, I guess, or splitting. Like if you spin up two new spawners, how does our world know about them?
Yeah, each one of these services has its own auto-scaling group in AWS, and so like each one of them is behind its own load balancer, and you know all of it's AWS trickery. That stuff's amazing.
That's great. So that's just the services and the servers that we spin up for it. So what's actually running on all those things is yet another checklist of technology. So
yeah, so I can
that stuff.
Yeah, let's run down them. I mean, we use some pretty normal stuff and then some pretty like newish or weirdish stuff. EFS is probably the linchpin of what we're doing here, and that's the
electronic file system, or what is it?
I think it's Elastic. Electronic. I'm going to assume all of AWS is electronic. That's just, I'm going to make a wild guess, but maybe they have some physical stuff running somewhere. So Elastic, their Elastic file system is basically like, if anyone's worked with in an office, it's NFS or like basically a file share. So if you've ever worked in a place where Frank's like, hey, store the files on the server, and you open up a little console and you put them, You store your files sort of like in this basket and in on your corporate file system. That's right. What this is. In the
Why
past,
is that different than S3? Isn't that the same? Isn't that a file system too, or not really?
Well, so S3 is like an object store, and it just works differently. NFS acts exactly like a file system on your local machine or like on a server, whereas S3 is an object store, and it has different properties. In our case, the property we care about is that we run gulp in order to pre-process your files, and NFS, the file system, or EFS, emits it emits events when a file is touched, when a file is changed, and we need that, like gulp needs that in order to see what is happening.
Okay, so it's this real, it's a straight up real file system in which that you can like put new files and run code on files and stuff. And
yeah, it acts exactly like the file system that's on, that's like native to your server. It's just that file system can be attached to lots of AWS nodes at the same time. That's what makes EFS sort of special and NFS sort of special. And so that like every single box, maybe not every single one of them, but in that big list, like of a large majority of them, are connected to the same EFS volume, meaning like they can, like all these different servers can see the same volume and can interact with the files that we're saving. Because, for example, when you preview something, Nginx needs to read off the file system and display the HTML, CSS, or JavaScript files. Or like when you save something, gulp needs to be able to read, know that you saved it, transform that SCSS file into a CSS file, for example. So
one question I have, Tim, is, and I think maybe some people might have this question if they're considering EFS, what do you think about the speed of the interaction with EFS? Like, how has that been? Has that been a bottleneck for us?
Yeah, I mean, so sure, if you hear me talking about this or you read about it and you're like, oh, this will solve all my problems before, you know, I had to move files around on my network. Now I can just attach a volume. That's not necessarily the case. EFS is super slow, like an order of magnitude slower than working with files on your local file system. Yeah. So you do have to be careful about what kind of workload you're putting, you're doing on it.
Is there it natural, or will someday AWS just be like, now announcing EFS is now as fast as anything else in the world?
I mean, it's all, so yeah, I guess like over time, this thing could speed up, right? Because what you have is the bottleneck is the network, and then the like file locking mechanisms that have to happen over the network. So EFS, like on your local machine, if two processes try and write to the same file at the same time, your operating system is going to handle this problem and be like, oh, the one who asked for it first is going to get to write to it first. But if two disparate machines try and write to the same EFS volume, there has to be a network call that happens over the network and says, hey, is it okay to write to this? And the EFS volume's like, yeah, it is. You can go first, system one. Okay. And if system two is asking the same question, that has to happen on system two as well.
So, we all know the internet, not super fast.
So this is, yeah, I mean, this is inside AWS, so it's going to be faster. And as networks get faster, you know, this will inherently do so. But, you know, this thing's EFS is perfect if you're trying to move around, like trying to share bigger files that aren't frequently accessed among lots of machines. In our case, it just happens to be that we can handle, like, our system characteristics allow us to deal with the latency. We don't feel it that much. There are times, though, for example, if you've got a large project and we're trying to push all those files up to S3 to store them, for example, during an export, that process takes way longer than it would if that were a local file system.
So S3 is involved a little bit here. I don't know if we plan to talk about that, but it's kind of like your project, when you make one on CodePen, exists in EFS. We fake what that looks like in the browser through all that React stuff or whatever, because we have like a database representation of like what is in your file system. And, you know, ideally, we kind of have to keep those in sync, which, you know, we do through computer programming. But also, occasionally do actually put it on S3. Like, when you, that's what deployment is as part of CodePen projects, is kind of like moving from EFS to S3, yeah?
Yeah, that's correct. So, we serve all of these. If we're serving your previews for you, like when you're in your editor, the project editor, and we refresh the browser, the pane at the bottom, and show the results of your changes in the browser, that's being served off EFS. But if you've published your project to the cloud, I guess, like if you press deploy, we store it on S3. And we do that because like those files don't change regularly and we don't need to react to them the way that we do with the EFS file system. So a deploy is like a point in time snapshot. So that's a perfect thing for
better,
S3.
Faster CDN, all that stuff.
All that sort of stuff, yeah.
This episode of CodePen Radio is brought to you by Hired.com. That's Hired.com/CodePen. Go there, and it's, you know, it's free for you. If you're looking for a job, this is the place you go. Go through the sign-up process. Tell it all about yourself. It's information. If you're looking for a job, it's information you've already gathered about yourself and your work history and all that stuff, because you're out there looking for a job. And it matches you up with companies who are looking for you. So it puts, you know, they're the matchmakers. It puts you together. You get a big signing bonus if you get hired anyway, so you might as well go through here. Big companies that you've heard of course, are hiring on Hired.com, and it's free for you, so you might as well do this kind of thing. It's for tech workers like you, software engineers, product managers, data scientists, designers. So you go through the Hired.com/CodePen sign up process and see what you get out of it. If you're looking for a job, you might as well. Okay, so what else? So now we have EFS. Does it, like, I'm even a little kind of confused. So when I think of Docker as this like totally isolated like little world, do we have to move the files from EFS into individual Docker containers, or do the Docker containers like still just like ask EFS for like what's going on?
It's interesting. We take the EFS volume and we mount it to the host file system.
It's a volume. I kind of get that, because I had to make my Docker, I switched my WordPress instance to Docker, and I made my database a volume on purpose because I didn't really want it inside the container. I don't know if I have the terminology correct there, but
no, you got it perfect.
Before I did that, which was like months, once in a while, my Docker container would just like rebuild itself for some unknown reason to me, which is normally fine. You're not supposed to care about that. But my database would be wiped. And I'd be like, dude, why? Yes. Because you have to make it a volume that lives outside of the normal Docker.
Yes. Yeah, so volumes as a concept are not just a Docker thing. That's like a, you know, that's a, that's a software thing. You know, that's a...
like an operating system thing.
Yeah, it's an operating system thing. Thanks for helping me out with that. But
you put a disk in your disk drive and it shows up. It's a volume.
Right.
So that's the thing. You mount the EFS volume to the host system, and then when you start a container, you mount a path on that volume inside the Docker container. And that's how like you get your own little file system in each and every container that gets started up. You're essentially getting a path.
So I think of like FTP or something where I like log in from my Mac to some other server and I can mess around with the files in there. That's a little bit like a volume, but there's even software like FTP software for my Mac here that like through some kind of magic mounts that server as a volume. So it it looks as if those files are natively on my operating system. And I could operate on them with Gulp or whatever if I wanted to.
Yeah, I mean, it would be super slow over FTP possibly. But yeah, either way, like, yeah, I mean, EFS is this sort of like magical thing that came out right around, it like was released out of preview right around the time we started working on this project.
That's serendipity,
yeah. Yeah, really, really did work out pretty well for us. I don't know, you know, there could have been other ways we could have handled this, but this so far has been a huge boon for us to be able to leverage EFS.
It's kind of cool. It means it's new and it'll only get better. So there's more checklist stuff to go down here.
Yeah, so we use console, which is this like distributed key value store. We use that for storing like where, you know, which box a container is living on.
Sounds like Redis, but
yeah, it is Redis. It just has like a bunch of other smarts built into it. It's Redis doesn't have like a really great cluster situation. It is pretty highly available, but console just sort of works. It has a bunch of other tools that are sort of network aware and allows you to deal with. I guess it has some abstractions that are different from Redis. For example, it has the concept of a node or the concept of a service. Console is like more ready for dealing with network concepts, whereas Nginx is just this bucket where you can define whatever you want. Console has some constraints, and they're helpers in a sense that help you out.
Cool. So console's there, key value store, which stores stuff like, I don't know, what container is where? Or?
Basically, yeah, like what's the IP that this current container is running on is a perfect example of what console is storing. We use Nginx all over the place. I had mentioned that. Like basically Nginx, when you make a request against Nginx, that reads off EFS and it caches the files and serves them up to you. That's sort of like a linchpin of the internet. A lot of people are using that.
Indeed, because of course we're building a web app here. We need web servers.
Yeah. One of the cooler technologies we used was a project called MessageBus, which is like this pub/sub library. It allows, there's a JavaScript client piece that runs in the browser and allows the client to long poll against the server. And then there's another server-side component where on the server we can push messages to the MessageBus, and because the client is listening to it, the messages sort of like get passed down the wire. So it's a way for the back end, any of these back end services, to talk to the front end in a sort of an asynchronous manner. Like you publish an event to this down the wire, and the eventually the front end will get that through the
like message a web
bus.
Socket, but
yeah. So I think MessageBus purposely doesn't use web sockets. It uses like the dumbest possible method, which is the most reliable, which is just a long HTTP request. And I think over time they'll be able to use web sockets.
Yeah,
go ahead, Alex.
It's interesting in that PubNub kind of does the same thing. I thought they did. Maybe it's been a while since I looked at what they were doing internally, but I noticed that they also rely on that same technology. I think it's just it makes it reliable across browsers and devices and things like that. I imagine it's a bit of a nightmare to try to move from WebSocket and, you know, supporting all the different devices that are out there. So it's interesting to know that MessageBus does the same thing.
Yeah, when we had looked at different technologies for doing this sort of stuff, the fallback was always long pole, and it always sounded dirty. They're like, oh, but if everything else fails, you can long pole. But
right. Yeah, so now long poling is cool again?
I'm not really sure. I don't know where it falls in. I guess for folks like us that don't want to deal with the sort of finickiness of different technologies, WebSockets, the message bus seems to be a good choice. And,
The reason we can't use PubNub is because we can't install PubNub on our own server. We need to install this on our servers, right? We use PubNub when we can do it client to client.
Well, you actually can use PubNub for that reason. I think we did it because we didn't want to max out the number of connections that we wanted to use. But you can use PubNub on the back end Rails and send messages and things like that.
It's just this is free too. That doesn't hurt.
Yeah,
this is built into the stuff. We don't have to think about connecting and paying and
so this is a big deal, right? It's Gulp has you've saved an SCSS file with changes. So, okay, it goes up to EFS and EFS accepts the changed file and there's something watching it that's like, oh, a file has changed, which triggers Gulp because Gulp's sitting there waiting, watching for files to change. That's all living in this Docker container. It does the job. It processes the SAS, which either errors or doesn't error or whatever. Maybe it saves out a .css file. And then it's like, okay, great. Everything happened like it was supposed to, but our front end needs to know what went down on the file system. And that's what MessageBus is for, right? Like sending all that information back up to the front end so our front end can deal with it.
Yeah, basically, there's the next technology we're going to talk about is called FluentD, and that's like a log listener. So every time that, and I'll get back to what you're saying by explaining how FluentD works. FluentD, every time Gulp makes an output, it writes to a log. We have FluentD listening to those logs, and then FluentD is basically a log listener that allows you to respond with code that you've written. So when a new log line comes in, FluentD is like, oh, I've got a plugin that CodePen wrote. I'm going to do whatever it says. And in this case, what it says to do is, hey, call out to MessageBus and send a message down the wire to the front end that something has happened. So, these two technologies, MessageBus and FluentD, sort of work hand in hand to allow the back end to talk to the front end in a speedy and efficient way.
Yeah, it's funny that so it's not really our bottleneck. Those things are pretty damn fast. The bottleneck is really Gulp, isn't it?
Yeah, and I mean in this case it's Gulp and the time that it takes Gulp to start up and then the time that it takes Gulp to react to the file system and then also EFS itself being kind of slow if it has to read a bunch of files that in itself take some time. So our biggest bottleneck still is what it always is in operating system stuff. It's IO. It's reading off the disk and writing to the disk.
Wow. Okay. So a lot of this is happening in the Docker container. So somebody starts a new project. We're like, got it. We're going to do this thing. We're going to spawn one or whatever, spin up a new Docker. It's going to go to one of our 12 servers that's just waiting to have a Docker spun up on it. And it's not those, there's a lot more than 12 Dockers can happen at any given time. Any one of those servers could have hundreds of Dockers on it, right?
Yeah. So each one can run a container. So each Docker host can run, when we load tested this, it was up to 150 of these Docker containers at any given time that were writing and reading constantly. I'm sure you could pack a lot more of them in if they were sort of idle. But in our case, if they're pretty active, we can sit about 150 of those per
server.
Per server, yeah.
So when one gets spun up, IP addresses for where it is get saved or whatever. So the front end and back end just knows what's going on. It knows who to talk to and who to communicate with. So that's spun up, and then the file system is mounted, and Gulp is watching what's going on there. And so changes happen on the front end that get saved to EFS, and then. Things happen in the Docker container and FluentD is watching and message buses get sent and the front end reacts and the dance pursues or whatever. At some point, if you are inactive for a while, I think we spin down your Docker container. Yeah.
Yeah, so there's a lot of sort of outside services working like that, or I guess sort of constraints to the system working like that. But yeah, spinning stuff up and down is one of them. We don't want to keep these things running at all times. There's a number of reasons for that. One of them is that like it would take up resources that weren't being used. Number two is if someone's doing something sort of nefarious, you have basically 4 minutes or so before your Docker container shut down and the next one started up elsewhere. It also helps balance the load. If someone's doing something that's really heavy weight, like if they have a huge project at least, and it was sitting next to another huge project, those two at least would be moving around our network, so that you reduce or at least spread the load out theoretically, so that at any given time, two hot projects won't always be sitting right next to one another.
And so that's just Docker, but there's another Docker technology that's fairly new that we also use.
We're using Docker Swarm for a lot of this stuff. That's for like spinning up and down. Docker containers. I'm starting to realize that this podcast, I originally was concerned that we wouldn't fill the time, and now we're coming up on 30 minutes. It might not be a bad idea to split this into two things, because we have like another two pages of stuff where we're talking about like what's Docker and what's Docker Swarm. Do you think this is a good place to end it? Because we've talked about this.
So just because we've teased it now, we can cut it. But what the heck is Docker Swarm, and is it actually new? And what? Like, let's end on Docker Swarm, and then we'll pick it up with a more Docker specific one later.
Yeah. So Docker Swarm is like a container scheduling technology. Originally, when Docker first came out, you would just say like Docker run on each machine that you were trying on each. Yeah, node that you were trying to start a container on. What Docker Swarm does is it's aware of all the nodes that you could run containers on, and then will start a container on a given node based on constraints. So, for example, we've got these. We got a handful of these servers that are just dedicated to processing your gulp stuff. So we've set up labels on those nodes that the Docker scheduler understands, that Docker Swarm understands. And when you say Docker run, you don't have to say Docker run on this particular IP. You're just like, hey, run this somewhere within the constraints that we've set up, and route me to this place when I need to do other stuff to this container, when I need to shut it down, when I need to reboot it, when I need to do other things. Docker Swarm is this technology that keeps me, the operator, from having to think about where this container is going to be run. You just know that you have a bunch of servers that are ready to run containers, and the Swarm technology is going to be aware of that and run the containers in the right place.
That's kind of awesome. And another one of those like serendipitous things, like, God, there's so many technologies that came together at about the right time to allow us to do what we did.
Yeah, I mean, they were running Swarm Classic, which we still have to use in some cases for a while. I think that had been around for a year or two. And then Swarm Mode is like the new version of Swarm Classic. And that had some constraints that didn't allow us to use that for all of our pieces. So we use Swarm Classic in some places and Swarm Mode in other places. And we can get into that. I think we're having Brett on, who is a Docker captain, and he and I are going to do this sort of like lessons learned thing where we go into like, why do we use Swarm Mode in some places and Swarm Classic in others, and what were the constraints of the system and why didn't this work? So stay tuned for that. I think there's some more interesting stuff that we can talk about.
Okay, sounds good, everybody. So look forward to more Propeller Head action coming up. And there's tons of shows coming up. So hopefully you enjoy this kind of thing and learning about the behind the scenes of how CodePen works. Hopefully some of this is applicable to what you do, or if not, is at least interesting. Take care. Cool.
All right, bye, thanks, everyone. Bye.
Seven six zero three one eight.